Category E5, News Reporter of the Year, Kieran Cuddihy.
To News Talk Breakfast may know that last Friday on the programme we revealed 25 disability charities had their funding cut by the Department of the Environment over the course of last week, and the 25 included some of the best known charities in the country like MS Ireland, the Alzheimer's Society, Autism Action Ireland, but the biggest impact is going to be felt by smaller charities because of course they don't have as many people to take those type of cuts. And this morning we're going to focus in on one of them, the Huntington's Disease Association of Ireland. Kieran Cuddihy brought us the story of all of those cuts, and he is here again to go into some depth into this organisation. So first of all, let's talk about the condition. What is Huntington's, Kieran?
It's a hereditary neurological disorder. So what it does is it causes brain cell degradation, and then your physical, cognitive, emotional well-being all deteriorate. So it's described to me by a few different people as like a mixture between Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS and a few other conditions. And some health professionals actually I spoke to referred to this, it has a nickname, they call it the cruelest disease. And actually the more you learn about it, the more you realise that's a really accurate description. There's about 700 people in Ireland with the disease, and they're represented, as you said, by the Huntington's Disease Association, who are one of those 25 charities.
Okay, so thankfully a small group of people, 700, but nonetheless a significant number. They've had a representative association working for them. How hard was that association hit?
They lost about 20% of their funding overnight, which is a huge, huge chunk for any organisation to have to absorb, especially one so small. This, of course, places question marks on the services that they can provide, their ability to maintain those services, and possibly down the line, if something doesn't change on their long-term survival, to lose that much with just a stroke of a pen. Consequently, this impacts on people who are suffering with Huntington's. And I met a family who are living firmly in its shadow. Their names are the Keneally's, and they live just outside Dublin. They were kind enough to invite me into their home. Their Huntington story is really tragic, Chris. The family consists of Susie and Martin and their three children. And Susie explained to me how their whole journey with the disease started back when she first met Martin.
Martin's mum was ill, but she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And we got married, we had children, and it was only when our last child was 5 years old that my mother-in-law was properly diagnosed. She didn't have Alzheimer's, she had Huntington's. So straight away, all of her children and grandchildren were instantly at risk. My husband was called in late 98 and got his results in 99. Ironically, on our wedding anniversary, our 14th wedding anniversary, he was diagnosed. Our eldest child always said from she was 14 years old, and this is how she marked down her birthdays. On our 14th birthday, only 4 years to go. On our 15th birthday, only 3 years to go. And she actually rang the day that she turned 18. She was always determined that she needed to know, she wanted to know. And unfortunately, she did not get a good result. She too tested positive. She was only 19. She had literally just gone 19.
Wow. So you have an elder in a family diagnosed, and you can see this domino effect. As what's the story with the 14 to 18 significance? Do you have to be an adult to be tested?
You have to be an adult. You can't get your children tested. It has to be their own decision. So they wait until they're 18, until they're at the age of consent, and then they decide to do it themselves. So in this case, there's three kids in the Keneally family. We heard one of them there was tested and has the disease. Another doesn't have the disease, and a third child doesn't want to be tested. Would prefer to live without that knowledge, without that certainty. Those diagnoses happened from, like as you heard there, kind of the late 90s on. And in the time since, for Martin, for the dad, the disease has really taken hold and taken over his life. And Susie just told me about the quality of life he currently enjoys.
Well, right now he is pretty much near end stage. He can do absolutely nothing for himself. He has to be washed and shaved and dressed. He has to be fed. He can't stand, he can't walk, he can't communicate. I go see him regularly and I sit with him. But when he sees me, the only thing that he can do is laugh or cry. And unfortunately, lately, he does a lot more crying than laughing. And it is so hard to sit and watch him. But it is heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking, and it's heartbreaking for my children to go and sit with them and see that, because at least for one of them, they know this is ahead of them.
Mm. You spoke to, it's the eldest child who has the positive diagnosis. You spoke to her.
Yeah, Aisling. And I should say at the outset, she is really impressive. She's just really positive about her condition, as positive as she can be. You know, this is a fact about her life. She can't change it. She just tries to live as normal a life as possible. And a lot of the things when you're chatting to her, she's like any 20-something-year-old, you know, talking about travelling, what she wants to do later. But you heard Susie there just talking about visiting Martin and the impact that has on her and on her kids. And I had to ask Aisling what that experience is like for her.
It can be hard. When we go in to visit him, like, we often try to go together because right now he's very unresponsive. So if we're kind of joking with each other, he'll laugh. Like, that's the only way we kind of get a rise out of him. But if I go in by myself and there's nothing to talk about and he's not responding, there's times when I'm just looking at him thinking, like, is that what's going to happen?
Is it something that defines you? Do you think about it all the time?
I don't really think about it all the time, but I certainly think it's helped shape who I am. I've really learned a lot about myself, and I've also learned a lot about people and how they react to things like this. Like, when the going gets tough and the people who disappear, they're really not worth having in your life.
Aisling speaking to Kieran there. It's really interesting, in three children in one family, you know, all the different choices that we all make. In three children, one was determined to be tested, another is determined not to be. So it's really interesting how we all deal with different things. But on that, having a diagnosis of no remission, no cure, no treatment, what type of a bearing is that having on Aisling's plans for life?
Like, she, as I said, she tries to live as normal a life as possible, but this is a huge, huge bearing on her. She says it doesn't define her, but it's there all the time. Like, she was talking about boyfriends, for example. Like, when does she tell them that she has the disease? She kind of has a rule of about a month, she was saying. This, a month in, you tell them. But that's a fairly serious conversation to have with someone when you're 20-something, to say you have a disease, it's terminal, and it could affect any children that we might have. That would scare a lot of people away, even that mention a commitment like that. But she also talk about kids then the future, like they'd have a 50-50 chance of getting the disease. She was talking about adoption or genetic screening of embryos and IVF. But even at that, she knows she'd be unlikely to be around to see them have their own kids or to, say, graduate from college or something like that. And these are fairly weighty issues for any 20-something-year-old to be dealing with. And Aisling was saying that the Huntington's Association, in that regard, has been a huge help to her.
The HD Association, they have weekends away. They have weekends to Cushla. And it's great because people can just get together. And it's somewhere you can go and not have to explain yourself constantly. Because every time I meet somebody and, you know, somebody new, what does your man do? What does your dad do? Oh, well, my dad's terminally ill. He's got Huntington's. What is that? And it's just like, well, how do you explain all the heartache and the pain and the depression and all of the struggles that we've had over the last, like, 20 odd years into three or four sentences? So it's nice going to all these meetings and info days and all this kind of stuff organized by the association, because you can just go and talk and have tea or cry or eat chocolate or whatever it is that you do to kind of de-stress.
Yeah, that view actually is shared by Aisling's mother. She best explained, I suppose, the value of the association to me when at one stage during our conversation she placed some photographs out on the table in front of me and described what was in them.
Yes, it is photographs of my husband from when he was younger, and then just photographs through all the progression of his illness. And I'm just looking at one here that was taken, you know, a short time ago, and it just shows his physical self right now, which is really, really not good. But then there's another photograph here of him when he was younger with our three children. But all I can see is this photograph of him, end-stage Huntington's, and then I look at my girl and I know in the future she's going to be exactly like him. And that breaks my heart. And the only thing that supports me and keeps me going is the Huntington's Association and all of the other Huntington's family in the country. We help each other, we support each other. It is our lifeline. And we cannot let it go.
That was Susie Keneally speaking to Kieran Cudahy. From the outset, thank you to the Keneally family, both Susie and Martin and their children, for telling this story on air. The Huntington's Disease Association will be talking to us after 9 o'clock. One of 25 charities that had their funding cut by the Department of the Environment last week. Quietly under the radar, we've been highlighting it since Friday. Before you go, Kieran, has that department said anything?
Yeah, the scheme through which they were funding them is the Scheme to Support National Organisations in the Community and Voluntary Sector. And they the department say that basically what happened was they opened up applications for funding and that there was just, they were oversubscribed. There was too many people wanted funding. They couldn't give it to everyone. And that was essentially, that was the statement. There was just too many, there was not enough money to go around. But there's an appeals process, and if people feel they've been hard done by, they can appeal.
10 past 8 on News Talk Breakfast this Thursday morning. We want to turn to an issue we've been pursuing vigorously on this programme, the issue of poor quality housing estates built during the Celtic Tiger era and the issue of fire safety. Recently on the show, we brought you the story of the housing estate in Newbridge, County Kildare, called Millfield Manor. Serious fire safety concerns were raised in relation to the 90 houses on the estate after 6 of them were destroyed very rapidly by fire. A report carried out by the council found that in another 10 homes they inspected after the fire, a number of deficiencies existed in relation to fire safety. At the time, we speculated how widespread was this problem given the volume of new homes built at that time. Well, this morning, our reporter Kieran Cuddy has details of another housing complex, this time in County Meath, where families with young children say their homes are literally fire hazards. Kieran, where'd you go?
I was in a place called Riverwalk Court. It's in Rathoughton, County Meath, at the village end of the Ferry House Road, for people who know the area. It's 26 apartments and duplexes, and it's what's called a multi-unit timber frame development. So timber frame structure, three different structures that they're in around a courtyard. And what I have here in front of me in relation to those 26 units are copies of two reports carried out by separate specialist engineering firms that both detail breaches of building regulations at the development, and those breaches include fire safety regulations.
So when were these houses built?
They were built 2004-2005, and initially problems first appeared in about 2007. And the problems that appeared first were water ingress, so leak and damps in the wall, but really serious leak and damps. I've been out there a few times, and there's a little bulge in the building the whole way around, about 20 feet up, and what it is that the top floor is actually sinking into the floors below, that the wood is so rotten. So if you think of like a sponge cake, if you have three layers and the top layer is heavier, and it's sinking down into the layers below. So when this became obvious, all these problems, the residents went to Premier Insurance, who's like the UK-based version of Home Bond, which is a 10-year structure guarantee people get on new homes. Premier needed to know how bad the problems were. Investigations were started, and it quickly became apparent that there was other issues with the site. So the management company hired an engineering firm, and what they ultimately found was, along with these water ingress problems, there was breaches of fire safety building regulations. That's what they found in their report. And I should say, the second report I have, also done by another completely independent engineer, makes similar findings. And what the findings were is that there's, say, no fire stopping between separating walls, no cavity barriers at floors, no vertical cavity barriers, wrong plasterboards in the roof, problems with the joists, and it goes on and goes on. What all that means is that if a fire breaks out, it'll just spread too quickly. So the regulations, the building regulations that are there, what they stipulate is that if a fire starts, it should be contained in an apartment for 60 minutes before spreading. And that's the idea, is it gives people time to escape. And the people here we're talking about are families with young children in Riverwalk Court, and their lives are potentially in danger because the regulations haven't been met, according to the reports.
So not only do you have the two reports, you've been speaking to the residents.
I've been out there a few times, and I've met a lot of different residents, and the first one I want to introduce you to is a lady named Sylvia. She lives in one of the duplex apartments, and she just told me about how the fact that she knows about the contents of the report, and she knows that these fire hazards exist, and the effect that that's having, not just on her life but on her son's life.
You don't sleep. The slightest noise, you're up, you're checking stuff, you're making sure every day you're checking that your fire alarms work, your carbon monoxide alarms work, everything works. But it's not just what you don't do, it's the effect it's having on the kids themselves. All the friends are gone that lived here. All the friends that they have in school won't come here because their parents won't allow them to come here. And I wouldn't have them here because it's too dangerous to have them over the house. So his friends aren't coming over to play in his room. There's no play dates. He's not been asked then to play dates because of this, because normally people, you know, will take a child over and you take the child the next time. It's hard on him. He thinks he's no friends. And then he's asking questions. Mommy, is there something wrong with our house? Is our house going to fall down? And you're trying to lie to him by saying no, because you want him to sleep and you want him to be okay and not to be stressed. Because he's seven. He can read. He can see the signs. He can see the builders out there. He knows there's problems.
Yeah, that was Sylvia there talking about, I suppose, the effect that's having on her life. But I also asked Sylvia maybe a question that listeners might be wondering themselves. If it's that bad, why herself, her partner and their son didn't move out?
No, it's not as easy as that, because where we're living at the moment, there's nowhere within our budget for start to move to. Anything that we've looked at is 1,800 a month or more, and we can't afford to do that. If we do move further afield, we have to move him from a school, which we can't do. We were taking him away then from his friends that he does have. So we're kind of just stuck here at the minute until either we do decide to move schools or the rent comes down or somebody helps us. That's basically it, or gets these problems solved.
Other than Sylvia, are nearly all the residents concerned about this?
Yeah, I spoke to a huge amount of them. Now, I didn't meet every single resident out there, but everyone I did shared similar concerns, and especially the residents with young kids like Sylvia, because I suppose they're not just thinking about getting themselves out if there happened to be a fire. So take, for example, these next two women, Catherine and Rachel. They both live there as well. They both have young families living with them.
Like, literally, we have thought to ourselves, if there was a fire in the downstairs of the house, how would we get both of the children out of both of the rooms and get them to a balcony, which we would hope wouldn't collapse, or get them out the front door with no fireproofing on a wooden staircase?
Yeah, it's terrifying. It is terrifying because you're constantly thinking, like Sylvia said, you know, have I switched every single thing off? Is every fire alarm working? Like, you're constantly paranoid and on edge constantly about, I guess, the possibility of a fire breaking out and how you get out at 2 a.m, for example, with a 3-year-old safely.
Okay, so who's to blame? Is it the builder? Is it the regulator? And who's responsible now?
As the problem with responsibility is that under the regulations at the time, we've talked about the problems with these regulations, it's not exactly clear. And I put this exact set of circumstances to the Department of the Environment and Construction Industry Federation. Neither could say with certainty who might be responsible. The situation out in Riverwalk Court is one company owned the land, then there was a development company, and this is the crucial part, there was a building company then who were contracted to actually construct, put all of these together. That company was called Elk House Ireland. This company no longer exists. They were wound up in 2010. I made numerous attempts to get in contact with former management of them, but to no avail. When I got in touch with the development company, they directed me back to Elk House Ireland. They said the construction issues were under their remit. Right now, a number of the residents have issued legal proceedings in order to ascertain liability. Premier Insurance have done the same, because they're out there dealing with the water ingress problems. And I should say that they're actually fixing them at the moment, the scaffold up. They're going to deal with them. So at the end of this, damp won't be a problem, but the fire issues aren't covered by that policy. So whatever about responsibility, the one thing that is clear is that residents are going to be left in homes that soon they won't have any leaks, but will be, according to the reports, still be potential fire hazards.
Now, we've got Millfield Manor in Newbridge. We now have a housing estate in County Meath. How extensive might this problem be in terms of fire safety? You've been speaking to an expert.
Yeah, and I suppose we should mention there's Priory Hall as well, is the most well-known one almost. And I was speaking to Robin Knox is a guy, he's a fire and building regulations consultant, and he's kind of helped me understand all these various reports and what the terminology in them is and what it means in layman's. And he's worked on houses and estates and businesses all over the country for about 40 years. He actually worked a lot on the Stardust fire and everything as well. So he's an expert in this field. And he gave me his assessment of how widespread might be the problem of houses built largely during the boom not meeting the required fire safety standards.
The standard of fire protection, the standards of fire resistance, the standards of fireproofing are just so negligible and so terrible at this point in time that there are vast amounts of dwellings in this country. People die in dwellings. The vast amount of dwellings, particularly the semi-detached terrace and the apartment-type dwellings, there are a very, very high risk. Well, regretfully, I'd have to say that the existence after a fire of a number of body bags is really going to be the only telltale indicator that things are seriously wrong.
We had a similar national problem with pyrite, and a scheme was put in place. Do you see anything emerging, you know, as these death traps through fire hazards are brought to light all over the country?
Well, ultimately, the question of the regulations at the time, like I said, they're very unclear and it's hard to say pin responsibility. The other issue is that, like in this case, you're going to have a huge amount of companies that were behind the developments that have been wound up and don't exist anymore. Directors of those companies, a lot of the cases, aren't even in Ireland anymore. Like local authorities, I suppose local authorities are terrified, particularly in commuter counties, that there will be some sort of scheme that ultimately they'll have to fund. But it's certainly looking like, unless you're going to condemn houses and put people out in the street, someone's going to have to fund it, and they're the obvious one.
News Talk 106 to 108.